Shadows, a Clark Ashton Smith podcast.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to Season 1, Episode 18 of Strange Shadows, the Clark Ashton Smith podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Poynton.
And I'm the other one, Tim Mendes. And yeah, this show is basically a wrap-up of Season 1. We'll be looking back over recurring themes, our favourite words, and all that kind of good stuff. And we also have a couple of guests, don't we, Rob?
Yes, we do. We're very pleased to welcome Mark Griffin and Richard Wilson from the 30 Plus Minutes with H.P. Lovecraft podcast. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Nice. Lovely. But before we get into all that Smithian stuff, we've got a bit of an announcement to make, haven't we, Tim?
Oh, we do. And yeah, I've got to stop my voice going all high-pitched and excited. So I might let you do it.
Just... Do you want my stentorian tones?
Yeah, go on.
Well, as you may know, Tim and I and Shelley DeCruz from Graveheart Designs are in the process of organising the Innsmouth Literary Festival, which is going to be a Lovecraftian Weird Tales convention. It's going to be held September the 30th in Bedford, UK. And we're now very pleased to announce that we have as our special honoured guest, Mr. Ramsey Campbell, who's going to be making a live Zoom appearance for questions, a chat, and an interview, basically. So we're really pleased with that. Of course, we've got some other guests lined up as well as some gaming people and traders and everything else. But that's our big news. We're going to be speaking live to Ramsey Campbell.
Yeah, it's kind of a... People who've listened to any of my interviews about my own work will know that he's pretty much one of the biggest influences aside from Lovecraft. The reason I decided to make my own milieu and all the rest of it was because of the interaction between Ramsey Campbell and August Derleth. So yeah, I'm going to be doing the Wayne's World thing. I'm going to be... I was saying just before we come on that, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to put an elastic band on and do that whole addict thing and snap it every time I'm a massive fanboy.
So we are not worthy.
Exactly.
And we will be getting details out shortly of how you can book tickets for the event as well, so keep an eye out for that. Okay, so let's get back into our Volume 1, the end of the story, and welcome our guests again, Mark and Richard. So perhaps, guys, you could start with telling us a little bit about what you do and also how you got into Smith and what do you like about Smith?
Well, we started a podcast during COVID about Lovecraft, and we got and if you start studying Lovecraft, you eventually fall into Clark Ashton Smith. You know, you can't help but run into him. And he was, you know, he's regarded as kind of like, you know, one of the trilogies of like weird fiction, you know, with Robert E. Howard being the third one. And but he was one I was least familiar with. And so, you know, I was kind of like, you know, trying to read his stuff and basically trying to struggle with it and all that. And so it's like, I just had a hard time getting into his like inner writing, and found y'all's podcast. And it's helped me a lot, really, to get into him.
Oh, nice. Thanks.
How's that for a testimonial?
That's great.
Yeah, no, thanks. Yeah.
Ringing endorsement.
Yeah.
We'll be using that in the future.
Yeah. That was the whole ethos behind it, really, wasn't it, Rob? Because both Rob and I are like really into it. And we're kind of like, more people should be into it. So that was kind of the whole. So that's great. I mean, yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times when I start trying to read his stuff, I start like, almost like daydreaming because, you know, his words are almost like really ethereal.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, with y'all's like, you know, descriptions and, you know, how the stories are and all this helped me give me more of a foundation, you know, help me when reading them.
And I think for me, certainly I got a certain amount of the old Panther paperback of Smith and, you know, but there's a lot of stories here that I hadn't read before as well. I mean, some weren't even really printed, were they, Tim? Certainly weren't widely distributed anyway.
No.
So that's been a real pleasure as well, reading a lot of new stories, or new for me.
Same for me, because a lot of them weren't in any of his collections. Because, I mean, like especially the Panther ones, which were the widely printed ones in the United Kingdom, they were all like the Lost Worlds, and there was the Hyperborea one. And so it was kind of like the core ones. I mean, some of the stories, you know, I'd never even heard of that we read. And some of them have been absolute gold, you know.
Yeah. And how did you guys get into setting up your podcast? What's the story behind that?
I need something to keep myself preoccupied during the COVID.
Yeah, we had a lot of spare time during the pandemic as far as, you know, just something to do. And then technology has allowed, you know, to be able to, even if you're isolated in different, you know, your own homes and that type of thing through FaceTime and Zoom, all that type of thing, as far as all you've got to do is be able to get 3-4 people or whatever, however many people, you know, on a Zoom call together and start talking about, in this case, Lovecraft. And there you go.
And at first it started like almost like giving like little reports about like certain segments of his life. And I started mainly with his childhood. And then I had been in contact with Josie. And so I like ended up like him making him our first guest that we had in our show for 1 year anniversary.
Oh, wow.
And then like after that, I decided to keep having guests because I'd much rather have other people talk about Lovecraft than
let them do the heavy.
Yeah. I can talk to them directly about what questions I have.
But it's nice. I mean, it's something we said before. If there's two or three of you, you get two or three different perspectives on the story, and each person picks up something that another person might have missed or interprets it a different way.
Yeah.
That's the fun about having other people around. You know, they definitely give you very different ideas of things.
Yeah,
that's your perspectives.
And I guess with Lovecraft, there's an awful lot of scholarship now as well.
Yeah.
A huge...
I feel like Lovecraft is almost like affinity. You know, you just can't just like just start reading him. It's like almost like, you know, there's all these rabbit holes you can fall into of Lovecraft. You know, it's like in with Clark Ashton Smith, Robert E. Howard, you know, and like in all the other things, you know, even like really obscure writers, you know, like Robert Bloch or Edith Minotaur, you know, and
yeah.
And it was like there's all these little things you could fall into. You know, you'd study him for almost like forever, and it seemed like you always would know something new about him. And I just find that fascinating about Lovecraft. You know, it's like, because I thought I knew who Lovecraft was until COVID happened. And then I just happened to have the biography that Dallas Frank DeCam wrote. I know a lot of people really hate that biography, but I loved it. And I don't agree with everything he wrote in it, but it definitely opened my eyes to what Lovecraft was. And, you know, it's like, and just everything I thought I knew about him was completely wrong. So, and I thought I read everything by him. I found out I hadn't, especially his collaborations and his ghost works. And so, you know, started like digging that stuff. And, you know, and then there was his essays and then his letters, you know, it was almost like he kept going, you know. You know, he's almost like the Tupac of weird fiction, you know. So he's
just, where is this new material coming from?
Yeah.
I've always thought of Lovecraft as kind of like the dandelion of weird fiction. It's like, you know, you blow that dandelion clock and all the seeds go everywhere. It's like you look through everything, there's a little seed of Lovecraft in it, you know, not just fiction, video games, TV, films. Yeah. You can see little seeds of Lovecraft. It's like, you know, that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, because that's how I got into Lovecraft to begin with when I was younger, was not the core stories, but it's the proliferation in other media, like Doctor Strange comics, you know, and role-playing games and Metallica songs like that. It's like, and then it all curves back to like, oh, it's all from this guy.
all roads lead to Lovecraft kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think for me, it's that idea of we came out of the classic ghost era, the sort of M.R. James, Edwardian stuff, which obviously Lovecraft was big into. But he didn't really use a lot of supernatural stuff in his literature.
No.
I always think it's interesting that he's put out there as like a horror writer or a ghost writer. But actually, it's almost, as we say on the Innsworth Book Club, it's science fiction, a lot of it.
Yeah.
There were a few, like I just call it little ghost stories. There was one like the dollhouse where a guy was like having a dollhouse and he was witnessing like a reenactment of a murder that happened. All that. But that's the one I can remember the most by M.R. James.
Yes.
Yeah. Wasn't there a movie, Night of the Demons, something like that?
I know the one.
Yeah, Night of the Demon was Cast in the Runes, was an adaptation of that. It was a TV adaptation as well that was quite good.
Yes.
In the, I think it was in the 80s.
There's been several TV. I mean, the whole Ghost Stories for Christmas. We don't want to get into that debacle. If anybody's been on the M.R. James forums lately, oh no.
Yeah.
But there was also that. I don't think Dario Argento actually directed it, but he was involved in it. The Church, one of the Gallo films, that was The Treasure of Abbot Thomas.
Oh, right. Well, there's certainly been, I think the James adaptations have been more successful than the Lovecraft adaptations on the whole, with a few exceptions. And when it comes to Smith adaptations, there's virtually nothing as far as we've been able to find out.
Wasn't there
about three?
The Return of the Sorcerer, the Night Gallery thing.
There's a Night Gallery episode.
Yeah. Night Gallery.
I forget. It's like a Richard Stanley did a one for.
It was Mother of Toads for the Theatre Bazaar or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I went to sleep.
And there was a short adaptation of the Final Incantation, which I still haven't managed to find.
You're not tracking that one,
I've been trying to get hold of that for months and I can't get hold of it.
Is that the one? It's like they have a Kickstarter, like, you know, like saying, hey, we just need a little bit more money, get this done. You know?
Yeah. And apparently it got released, but I can't find it. I've been scouring the internet and I cannot find it.
The lost film.
I've heard there's one, I think it's called The Double Shadow, that, it's like I mentioned, IMDb, but I can't find anything about that, you know, like anything more than what was just there. And it just like, just mentioned it existed, and that was about it.
There was also Fulci's Dead trilogy, like The Beyond, City of the Living Dead. Those specifically, they were influenced by Smith. They weren't direct adaptations, but obviously you had the Book of Ebon in there, and they were kind of, and that sort of dreamlike quality. I see Rob glazing over because he isn't a fan.
He's checked out.
I am a fan of Fulci, but he is one of those directors. He's kind of Marmite. You either love him or hate him. And we're the two sides of the coin here. I love him, he hates him.
We are. There's not much we disagree on, but
no, yeah.
We just watched Beyond about a few months ago.
Oh, From Beyond.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. And as well as what's the other one? Miskatonic University, the Resonator, which is basically the CW version of, which like the, you know, young, pretty young people or whatever like that, you're messing with the Eldritch Unknown and that kind of thing. that kind of take on From Beyond.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was recently. Yeah, The Resonator, Miskatonic U. I've got a copy of it, but I still haven't brought myself to watch it because I know it's going to be dreadful.
Yeah, it's, it's got its moments. It's no From Beyond, but, you know.
It's not great, but it's a full entertainment movie. You know.
It's something we speculated on a few times during the season is why, because I think in many ways, Smith was the best writer out of the three on a, perhaps we could say on a technical level.
They
all had different qualities. And Smith seems to be the most forgotten or overlooked of the three. Is that because Robert E. Howard had like a Conan and a Solomon Kane, and Smith didn't really have any sort of characters as such?
Or ones, I guess, that took off, like his earlier got enmeshed in, you know, the consciousness, the way that Conan or, you know, like a Cthulhu or that kind of thing did, as far as, you know, like, oh, who created this thing? You know, like, was this, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't really have that. You know, that character.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that Block, because, I mean, at that time, he was known for his Lovecraftian fiction. I mean, he wrote quite a lot. Most of it is collected in the Chaosium book, Mysteries of the Worm. And it's really good stuff. But he only got known later with Psycho. I often wonder if Smith would have had that breakout story, a lot more people would talk about him. Because, I mean, he had characters that recurred, but not many.
Mm.
I wonder if that was the thing. Because, obviously, you had the recurrence of, like, Yogg-Sothoth and Cthulhu, and, obviously, he had his Conan. So I think Rob's probably hit the nail on the head there. Aside from Satan Prazeros and that Captain Douchebag or whatever he was. You know, the one who left all his crew.
Marooned in Andromeda. Yeah.
Douchebag. Yeah. Aside from that, there was no real recurrence. I mean, the only recurring thing was Soth Okura, really. And some of his other Lovecraftian deities. But I think they were used more by Lovecraft than they were by Smith.
Yeah.
So,
or there's, and as a result, they're associated with Lovecraft more. So,
yeah.
Even then, I suppose it's Smith Smith's Cthulhu mythos monsters, isn't it? Rather than, you know, they get subsumed into the Lovecraftian whole, which is quite Lovecraftian, really.
Well, that was my introduction. I hadn't read really all that much of his stuff. And then Mark Lemmy-Morrow, what is it, the Clark Ashton cycle, which is all like the Cthulhu-type stories and that type of thing. And that was, you know, where I was like, oh, yeah, these are really good.
Brilliant book.
Yeah, I think that was the same for Brilliant me. Book. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely came to him through Lovecraft.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think how I got into him was on the back of the paperbacks. So I used to spend a lot of time scouring through them. You know, cardboard boxes you used to find of paperbacks in the markets or bookshops.
Yes.
And I looked on the back and there was a Lovecraft quote on one of the Panther paperbacks. It was like, Smith is brilliant kind of thing, you know. And there was Belknap Long and Fritz Leiber. And I was like, right, I'm buying that. That's so I got into it like the same way. It was through Lovecraft. But yeah, that Clark Ashton cycle, for anybody who wants a really good introduction to Clark Ashton Smith's books, I've often said that's the one. It's such a great volume. Like all the Chaosium stuff, the supplementary stuff is also really interesting because you get like, I think it was Robert M. Price, wasn't it? Did all the introduction to all the stories and the big old biography and potted history. And so it's a really good introduction, I think.
Yeah, he did a really good job with that, you know, in kind of explaining like the inspirations. And it's interesting that, you know, Clark Ashton Smith would be inspired by one of Lovecraft's stories, but it wouldn't necessarily be like a knockoff. He would like do something completely different, you know, just use his almost like his little springboard, you know, he was just do his own thing, you know, that. He'd read that and go like, that's an interesting idea. I should do something else with that, you know.
And that's why it's so fascinating reading the letters between them as well. Some of which are quite short and are kind of, we had some rain this week. I've just sent off the ghoul to Farnsworth Wright. And other ones, particularly the Lovecraft ones, are like 15 pages without a break.
I was going to say Lovecraft's letters. They are like novellas, aren't they, some of them? I mean, blimey, I've got a volume of his letters with August Derleth. They're probably even worse. Just like the pair of them, just like ramble on for page after page after page. But it's always really entertaining. That's the thing.
He'll find interesting topics to discuss with people. I mean, he'll go into ancient Greek history, you know, and it's like, and like in some, he'll go into hex symbols in Pennsylvania, you know, a lot of way different subjects, you know, that we never expect, you know, Lovecraft to have. And it's really entertaining with Clark Ashton Smith because when they first start off, they're really formal, you know, they go like Mr. Smith, Mr. Lovecraft.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden they start using like the little nicknames they've given each other, you know, Clark Ashton, you know, like, HPL.
And it's the great return addresses you get sometimes from the nethermost abyss of the beyond.
Yeah. I was gonna say that. That's the best thing about the letters by far. Yeah. I mean, my favorite of the nicknames is Belknap Longs that Lovecraft come up with. Frank Chime Sleep Short. Chime Sleepius for short. it just always cracks me up. Yeah.
One of the best ones was Robert E. Howard, Two Gun Bob.
Two Gun Bob. Yeah.
It seems to a T, doesn't it? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's get into looking over the last season then. We've covered, all of the stories in the first volume. So it's the end of the story. And what we thought would be fun to do, as regular listeners will know, each episode we choose a favourite word or two or three, or sometimes four, from the story. So we thought it'd be fun to pick out a few of our favourite words from across the whole season. And following that, perhaps a favourite line or a favourite phrase or something from one of the stories. So who would like to start us off with a favourite word?
I'll do it. I'll go first. And this isn't, I bet you can guess what I'm going to say.
Got a fairly good idea, but
Ithyphallic.
Yes.
You knew it, didn't you? Right. Which is basically a statue with a woody. And it's basically a phallus but on a statue. And what I liked about that was when you delved into that, Rob, and you found the phobia.
Yes.
Ithyphallophobia.
Ithyphallophobia.
Yeah, it's a phobia of statues with erections.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have to say, if I had to choose a phobia, I think that would probably one I'd choose, because it doesn't really impact your life that much, does it? It's not like claustrophobia or agoraphobia or something.
You know? Gotta have
it. Every time I play Arkham Horror, because me and my partner are well into the Living Card game, and every time, you know, you get the traumas, basically, I keep expecting it to go with like somnambulism and you know, all the rest of it, ithophalophobia. I'm gonna cheer if I get it, but I don't think it's in the pack, unfortunately.
Perhaps a supplement will add it in or something. I don't know.
Oh man,
how about you, Mark? What have you got there?
One of my favorites is from the Abominations of Yondo, Mystery Arch.
You're talking about that one.
Someone who presides over a mystery.
Yeah, the official mystery presider.
That's nice, isn't
nice.
It?
Nice.
Yeah. What a job title, eh?
How does that come into conversation? You know, it's like, you know, he says, like, so what do you do for a living?
Well, I'm a licensed mystery arch.
Yeah.
I get the impression of a guy with a big sort of cloak or something. You know, it's like 7 foot, I am mystery arch.
He's got to have the big collar. The big collar with the suns and moons on it.
Okay, Richard, what are you choosing?
I just like the phonetics of nyctaloptic, because I've seen that one in there as far as what is this, the inability to see in dim light or at night, or night blindness, which I'm sure would make things far more, you know, terrifying for people in some of these.
It does sound good, that, doesn't it? It does sound like a sort of a creature or a being or something as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has this very cyclopean-ish, you know, type phonetics to it that does appeal to me.
I think the sound is why I chose one of mine, which was Nefandus, which was in the Necromantic Tale, which means blasphemous and not to be named or unnameable. Nefandus or Nefandus. Again, as regular listeners will know, we butcher pronunciations left, right, and centre. We're always open for corrections. Nefandus.
That was a very fan-like name. I can just see, like, someone having a band and call that. We're Nefandus.
Thanks for coming out.
Yeah.
And then I think I'm gonna just pitch in another one here, which was in fact, the last story we covered with Gavin, Orchidaceous, because I've been slipping that into conversation at every available opportunity. Might I say you're looking most orchidaceous today?
Oh, he has such a way with words.
For the very same reason, my second word is from the Monster of the Prophecy, is fulgurant. Basically, I've been trying to slip that into conversations. Basically, every story I've written since we did that episode has had the word fulgurant in it, which is flashing or dazzling like lightning. There's something about it. You can just wrap your tongue around it, can't you? Fulgurant.
It's one of those words. It doesn't sound like what it means.
No.
If you're fulgurant, I think of something sort of, I don't know, fruity and sort of growing or... lightning. It doesn't seem to connect. It's weird.
I just associate it with a coffee brand.
Yeah, we have a coffee brand called Folger.
Yeah, that was
nice.
The Folgers is Folgerant.
Helpful. Oh, that Folgerant for your aroma that it has.
What else have we got then? A couple more, shall we do?
Indeed.
I don't know how to pronounce this correctly or not. Immortelles.
Just work your way through it.
And for Scott Mullen's words, I never knew it actually existed for something that, you know, like, it was like, you know, the long-lasting flower arrangement placed on cemetery graves.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a new one on me as well. I have to say, well, like, quite a few of these were, but yeah. That's a kind of very Poe type of word, I feel.
Yeah.
I live close to a cemetery, so I see them all the time. So you always think about them, and like they always stay there so long. And, like, the wind will blow them because lumber and plastic, so like they're everywhere. So now I complain. I can complain about them.
Yeah, you can use the right terminology when complaining about them.
When I write a letter to the editor about them, I can use the correct word for it. About them.
He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, you use big words and they think you know what you're on about. Yeah, damn right.
He's so informed.
Yeah.
How about you, Richard? You got another one there you want to pick?
Yeah. Let me see here.
That one.
What? Corpus Delecti?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely a band name, isn't it? That, yeah.
That's a solid band name right there.
Yeah. No, it is a band name. They're a French goth band from the 1980s. really good. They reformed. I went to see them last year. they've been going since the mid-80s, Corpus Lecti. Yeah.
Demonian, really? Okay. Yeah. Relating to or having the nature of a demon, demonian. Okay, I'd heard it under a different context before, but never mind.
That sounds like a mispronunciation, like a third grader would go, like, you know, it's demonian.
I thought that was just after the Cambrian was the demonian, then the Jurassic. I always get those confused. Yeah. All right, and do we have a favorite sort of line or a couple of sentences or something like that? And I know that's a big ask because you could pretty much open any page in this book and pull something out, I feel. But
I do. And you know exactly what I'm going to say. And a hat tip to Mr. Gavin Chappell. It's pecuniary depletion from the tale of Sir Tamperor Zeroes.
Yes, yes.
I am in a state of pecuniary depletion. Yeah, I'm skint.
Yeah. I'm gonna read it because it's a lovely little passage. In our occupation, as in all others, the vicissitudes of fortune are oftentimes to be reckoned with, and the goddess Chance is not always prodigal of her favours. So it was that Tiruv Ompalios and I, at the time of which I write, have found ourselves in a condition of pecuniary depletion, which, though temporary, was nevertheless extreme and was quite inconvenient and annoying. I think we've all been there.
Oh, yeah. Many, many times.
Pecuniary depletion was going to be one of my phrases that are going to bring up and all that.
Mine too. It's my favorite one out of the whole
book. Love it.
That's my constant state, so you know.
Your default state. Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, you have certain phrases that you will forever associate with a certain author. Like, I always associate Gibbous Moon with H.P. Lovecraft, and that's partially because my copy of The Outsider had a misprint and it was Gibbon's Moon. So that gave me some interesting images, but I will forever think of pecuniary depletion with Smith. You know, it's up there with Robert Chambers's puffy grave worms.
You know? They're the best sort.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You don't want those non-puffy ones.
Yeah, plump and juicy. Yeah.
There was one phrase, what unimaginable horror of a protoplastic life for me. Protoplastic just kind of like, it made me think, what is protoplastic? And then I does. Like, a protoplast is a person or thing that comes first. You know, and I was not thinking, like, I was thinking of plastic. Mm. You know, it's like, you know, like, what we think of plastic. But it's like,
it meant something that's completely different by it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, like a prototype of something, like early human being life.
Yeah.
That one got me thinking. I was like, I'm just curious what he meant by that. And I like to go search the meaning of it.
Yeah, because it wouldn't have had at all the same sort of connotations that it does today, does it? We're in the pre-plastic era. I mean, it's
I think Bakelite went back then, wouldn't it?
I don't know if protoplasm even was a thing back then, was it? Would that have been, I don't know when these terms would have come into sort of popular use.
Well, I think Lovecraft used protoplasm a few times. Or that's just my brain thinking, because I've read it so many times describing Shoggoths that I think Lovecraft said it, maybe didn't.
So, I think I read that I think Jack Kirby used protoplasm, like in some New God stuff or something like that. So I'm trying to pull as far as where have I heard that before.
It's one of those words that people really love to use. Yeah. It sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I wonder sometimes, with Smith being a poet as well, I mean, people say this about Tolkien, that he really wrote his stories to be read out loud. And I wonder if there was something of that with Smith as well, because you certainly get quite a lot of alliterations, a lot of these lovely words, fulgurant and effulgent. I just wonder if that was a thing with him. I mean, some of them were prose poems virtually anyway, really.
I think that's one of the things I've really got an appreciation from doing this series, was his way of describing colour. You know, whereas a lot of writers, 90% of authors will say, and the sky was purple, Smith would say purpureal. And that is very poetic, isn't it?
Class it up a little bit. Come on.
Yeah. But that purpureal, I don't know, it's just so much more evocative than just saying it was a bit purple. You know?
It's like that extra bit of lace on the end of a sleeve, isn't it? You know, I just think that's sort of
indeed. Oh, now you're talking. Now you're talking.
Yeah. Class the place up a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get in then to what our favourite story out of Volume One is, and why? Why have we chosen that story above the others? And again, I think overall it's been a really high standard. In this, considering these are his first fiction stories as well, yeah. There's one or two that have dipped down a little bit. So again, I don't think this is necessarily an easy choice to make.
I would say that, I mean, going into this, my favourite Smith story was The Tale of Setampra Zeros, and it is still definitely up there. It's, you know, but I don't know. I think it's just because it was one of the first I read and the first that really resonated with me. But aside from that, I really liked A Night in Malignon. There was just something about that. The dreamlike quality. It was almost like I said at the time, it reminded me of that kind of Silent Hill thing, you know, almost like a purgatory kind of aspect to it. I don't know. There's just so much you can dive into with that story. Even though it's only about 5 pages long or something. It's barely more than a prose poem. But there's just something about the imagery in that and that funereal sort of pace to it. I don't know. It's one of them that's stuck with me. Yeah. So I've got to say that's got to be up there for me.
It's definitely a very compact story. It definitely has a lot going on for so short.
Mm.
And it does leave a lasting impression when you're done with it.
Yeah. How about you, Richard?
I hadn't had a chance to read all of these, but the ones that I did, as far as I really, ones I got this, the two that stood out, ones that stood out to me, I like Murder in the Fourth Dimension. I really enjoyed that one as far as that goes. And then Devotee of Evil is another one that I really, really enjoyed that one as well, as far as that's concerned. I mean, I had tried to get all of these read before our thing today, but ran out of time as far as that goes. But like, yeah, as far as, you know, that's a neat twist as far as, again, I'm on a murder, right? So Murder in the Fourth Dimension, as far as, you know, in terms of that, you know, bringing that kind of like aspect into it, as far as, because it's almost kind of like conventional, you know, crime type of thing, as far as, but then bringing in these, again, the supernatural element into it that I thought was really cool.
I thought it was amazing that someone hates somebody so much they would have been basically a time machine.
Yeah.
So they can murder somebody.
Yeah, exactly. As far as, taking your standard, it's like a murder mystery or crime thing or whatever, and like, okay, let's make this, you know, let's put our imagination into it.
And I think that's the thing with Smith. He can take something that you think, oh, this is quite a conventional type story, we're going to see this or that, but he always manages to spin it off in some very strange direction.
Yeah.
And stories like that, especially, I think we said at the time, would make great sort of Twilight Zone episodes. They have that kind of feel about them, don't they?
I'm surprised that more of it, particularly after the one, after I read the Clark Ashton cycle, and then some of these, as far as that they, not very many of them had, you know, been adapted into, because you'd think they're particularly with the length of them, make themselves very easily adaptable to, say, again, this kind of like the strange stories anthology-ish type of things, your Twilight Zones and your Outer Limits and that kind of thing. Yeah. That you hadn't seen more of these besides Return of the Sorcerer, as far as like, oh, let's grab this one and adapt it, you know, as far as that's concerned.
And especially because there'd be quite sort of there'd be effects light as well, wouldn't they? You don't really need a lot in terms of filming to adapt a story like that. How about you, Mark?
I'm gonna pick a really like dark horse one here. Metamorphosis of the World. That one is probably not his best one, but for some reason it just stuck with me. You know, it just seemed like, you know, that it was almost like he was writing like this tome in 1929 to warn us of what is happening today. You know, about the world is being destroyed. You know, it's and you know, when after, like, you know, y'all talked about it, I had to go and read it, you know, right then and there, and it had such a deep impact on me. You know, I could just see everything that was happening as he was describing it, and even hearing the sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that just And, you know, it's like, as far as, you know, his stories go, it's probably not his best, but it definitely left a big impression on me.
And yeah, quite prescient for its time as well. And was that the one that's set in 1979?
Yeah.
So it is weird now looking back at what was the future then.
Yeah. I always loved that kind of thing as far as, you know, was it Demolition Man or whatever that said in like 1999 or something like that? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And last year was Soylent Green.
Yes.
I forgot about that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And isn't Blade Runner coming up soon or have we already passed that one?
I'm not sure. No, I think we did because they were showing like the replicants' birthdays and that kind of thing. And Prison's birthday was, I want to say, you know, has happened already as far as she's already been, theoretically, she's already been born, you know, as far, you know.
Still got a lot for the sequel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll try to get there. We'll hobble up 2049.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Escape from New York was 1997, wasn't it? And, yeah. We should have had our hoverboards from Back to the Future 2 about 5 years ago, shouldn't we?
The future is now.
There's another episode we could do there on science fiction things that came true or are coming true, I guess.
Buck Rogers was being like they're doing the comic strips, like, you know, talking about them and honestly, like, you know, that they predicted the Polaroid camera.
Oh yeah, I'd forgotten about that. And
I don't know if that's really such a marvel of technology of now, you know.
I suppose that's the problem with science fiction. I mean, it can date very quickly. But then I suppose the other side of it is they say science fiction is often more about the time it's set in rather than the future in that sense.
Yeah, because it gives you a window into like this is what at that time, you know, the forecast really was for the future at that point where people thought things were going and whether or not they actually got there is a whole other story.
Almost like a warning, you know, like if we keep doing this, this is what's going to happen. You know? Yeah.
I think the biggest example is the flip phone from Star Trek, isn't it? That's how far we've advanced, folks.
Well, I think even when he was writing science fiction, he was writing it with an eye to fantasy in that sense, because again, all the descriptions, particularly with the Venus stories, are incredibly vivid.
Yeah, let's have some elegance to it, please.
And I think something we said is monsters are very rarely humanoid type guy in a rubber suit things. He always really stretched his imagination. To have things with seven legs and a giraffe's neck and the wings of a bee or something. And
you know. I think that's really quite a good point when talking about Smith, because his science fiction, it was all kind of rooted in that Edwardian. It was all brass and big tubes and, you know, it was all almost like a H.G. Wellesian kind of future, wasn't it? It was all very brass and tweed and plush velvets and things like that. And there's something really attractive about that kind of futurism. It's like, you know, the reality is going to be really dull, isn't it? It's going to all be steel and concrete and glass. You know, give me the velvets and all the rest of it, brass, man. Yeah. It was that one in one of the in the Voyage to Savannah Moe that we did recently. You know, the horse with too many legs and mushrooms sprouting from its
orchids. The orchidaceous horse.
Yeah, the orchidaceous horse. Now there's a pub name.
Yeah, go in there for a drink.
Yeah, let's go down the orchidaceous horse for a couple.
Two pints of mescaline, please. Well, I'm going to be a bit boring in a way and choose the obvious one, which is Satanpra Zeros.
Yep.
Because I think for me, I can't remember exactly when I first read it, but I'm pretty sure it would have been about the time we started getting into Dungeons and Dragons, sort of late 70s. And for me, that story above any other story, except maybe Tower of the Elephant by Robert E. Howard, really captures that early D&D vibe when we were playing with bits of graph paper and pencils and you had your three dice and a couple of figures before it all really went, I suppose, complex. I mean, any game can be, or role-playing game certainly can be as simple or as complex as you want it to be. But there was a certain simplicity to it back then and a certain atmosphere. And I think that story captures it perfectly.
Yeah.
But I would also mention Abominations of Yondu as well. If nothing else, aside from the language, just as an exercise in world building, because I think, as we said at the time, Smith manages to create a world and a history of this world from very little, just a couple of paragraphs, yet it feels incredibly dense and real and rich.
Yeah, Ramsey Campbell mentions it in the introduction. He singles that out as well, that basically in the first paragraph, you've got an entire world. You know, and it, you know, somebody like Ramsey Campbell is going, yeah, that's kind of impressive.
It's impressive.
It's kind of impressive, you know what I mean? So,
now, one thing we haven't really spoken about much so far, because we've been covering the stories, is how Smith approached his writing, how he got into it, how he actually wrote physically in some ways. So we thought it'd be interesting to take a look at some of that as well. And Tim mentioned you had something about Smith's typewriter.
I do, indeed. Yeah, because we talked about it on a recent episode, whether he typed things up and or wrote it shorthand. Now, there's not a lot in the letters talking directly about his writing process. It's more about, I mean, there's a bit I'm going to get into in a minute about his sort of phases. It was like he wrote in phases. He had a, you know, shiny, I'll do that kind of thing. But I found this lovely little bit because we were wondering. Basically, he had the same way Lovecraft had his commonplace book and would write shorthand ideas. Smith had the black book where he would write shorthand and all the rest of it. But then, yeah, he would then go off and do things. And whether he wrote them out shorthand or not. But anyway, here we go. This is a letter dated May the 23rd, 1933. Dear August, the new machine is a great acquisition. The last 3 years have been pretty hard on my old Remington, which I bought secondhand more than 2 decades ago. A machine with fresh type had become an absolute necessity, since I intend to prepare some of my work, both stories and poems, for submissions to book publishers next fall. And not the least advantage is that my carbons will no longer tax the eyesight of my friends. So there you go.
Nice.
I had contacted S.T. Josie about y'all's question, asking, so figured he would know more than anyone else, you know, did he type or write? And his response was, well, the answer to your question is complicated. There are plenty of letters by Smith that are handwritten. I can assure you of that because his handwriting is exceptionally hard to read. But there's also lots of type letters. I don't know if he had any rationale for handwriting or typing his letters. The earlier ones to Lovecraft letters are handwritten, but later on are generally typed. Most of the letters to Derleth are typed. I do not think it can be stated that Smith's early letters are handwritten and the later ones are typed. But there are a fair number of letters in the late 1930s that are handwritten. It may have something to do with whether or not the recipient was a personal friend or more of a literary or personal correspondent. In the latter instance, the letters were generally to be typed. So,
right.
Nice.
Right, that makes sense. Yeah.
So it just depend.
Yeah. Yeah, that figures because when Rob said that we were going to look into sort of his process as a writer and whether how he went about things, it is kind of really, there's no real pattern to it. Sometimes he would just go off and write things in a couple of days. Other times he would spend weeks, months even, agonizing over something and writing notes. Other times he would just completely pants it. It's really hard to pin down his process.
We do get this. This is a letter, November 1930. And I've got to read the return address for this one because this is one of those we spoke about earlier. So this is to HPL from the audience room of the Throned Worm in the knighted kingdom of Anchar on the road that is no longer used by living men between Abchaz and Georgia.
That's incredible.
I'd read a book, just a collection of those. Wouldn't you?
Yeah. I was going to say that that's a drabble there, isn't it?
And he wrote to Lovecraft, "I hope to hear that you have done some new stories before long. That commonplace book of which you speak must be a fascinating affair. I have formed more and more the habit of noting down ideas, since otherwise I tend to forget them wholly or in part." So he was keeping notes at some point.
That's what I'd got, like, hints of his black book.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it was it's in the introduction to the letters of August Derleth and Clark Ashton Smith. The editor says that about Smith's black book and compared it to Lovecraft's commonplace book. So there you go. Nice.
And was the commonplace book, does the copy of that still exist?
Well, it's what Derleth wrote all those stories out of. Yeah.
Right, so,
posthumous things.
That's where he took the ideas from. Whereas as far as we know, the black book wasn't found or doesn't exist.
I think the black book, you can find it on the Eldridge Dark website, because I think I've run it a few times.
Oh, right.
And the commonplace book has been reprinted. It's in one of the collection of essays for Lovecraft.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's where the snippets that became a lot of the posthumous collaborations between August Derleth and Lovecraft come from. Things like Innsmouth Clay and all that kind of stuff. That was that all came out of the commonplace book. And in some cases, it was literally just like a three-line synopsis, wasn't it, that Derleth then fleshed out. And I think it's strange that nobody's really done that with Smith's black book. I mean, there must be some interesting things in there.
Well, I think it's part of that thing where Lovecraft, where Smith never got the same recognition as Lovecraft. Yeah, I think it's changing. Yeah. I mean, there are people doing Smithian collections and stories now, or, you know, set in Zothic or Hyperborea, that kind of thing. So I think it's there. I think it's a little bit like the Robert Chambers King in Yellow mythos. It's got attached to Lovecraft, and that's brought it out into the light, which is probably not a good place for the King in Yellow to be.
No, absolutely not. No.
But that has spurred a lot of collections of King in Yellow type stories from different authors, right? So maybe we'll see more of that with Smith as he, hopefully, we're spearheading a Smith Renaissance.
You're at the forefront.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Well, that's the whole purpose of this podcast, isn't it? It's just to get it out there. You know, so good.
And as far as Smith's writing style goes, I found this, again, another letter to Lovecraft, and with yet another lovely return address. This one is October 1930. "In the world Sarkalosh, at the dawn of the red sun and the setting of the green." That's nice, a world with a red and a green sun going up and down. That's quite an image.
Nice.
And it's talking about The Whisper in Darkness. I think Lovecraft had just sent him The Whisper in Darkness. "As I told you in my last, I think your new Tao is among your best. It's a capital example of the theory you advance regarding the composition of weird stories, a theory which is undoubtedly the soundest one possible. My own conscious ideal has been to delude the reader into accepting an impossibility or series of impossibilities by means of a sort of verbal black magic, in the achievement of which I make use of prose rhythm, metaphor, simile, tone colour, counterpoint, and other stylistic resources, like a sort of incantation. You attain a black magic, perhaps unconsciously, in your pursuit of corroborative detail and verisimilitude. But I fear that I don't always attain verisimilitude in my pursuit of magic. However, I sometimes suspect that the wholly unconscious elements in writing are by far the most important." So I think it's an interesting contrast in some ways between Lovecraft and Smith, because Lovecraft has this reputation for never describing anything, and, you know, everything's unnameable, but he actually describes quite a lot, and he goes into quite a lot of detail. And Smith, I feel it's more dreamlike, absolutely, perhaps, than Lovecraft. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's about accurate. That's probably one reason why I have a hard time with Clark Ashton Smith. You know, it seems to me H.P. Lovecraft tried to ground things in reality to try to make them as believable as possible. And didn't seem like Clark Ashton Smith was concerned with reality. He wanted to make things kind of, you know, as you know, is it dreamlike or fantasy-like as possible for a story, and not trying to make it any type of, you know, setup for it.
And, yeah, because a lot of those, it kind of hit the ground running in these very alien-ish type of, you know, worlds and that type of thing, or like odd, you know, skate, you know, environments and that type of thing, and people that are, you know, you could certainly say are unrelatable as far as, you know, a pair of necromancers and, you know, that kind of, as opposed to, yeah, like you said, as far as Lovecraft would have like your point of view character, who's essentially, you know, your investigator or, you know, that kind of thing, as far as, and he's the one walking into this new environment or like learning and, you know, these horrors or that kind of thing. So that kind of can make it a little, for somebody just picking one up off the street or whatever to read, a little easier, more easily accessible.
Yeah. I'd say Lovecraft was probably more visceral, whereas Smith was probably more metaphysical, if that makes any sense whatsoever. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great description.
It's interesting comparing across the three again, where you've got Blood and Thunder with Bob.
Oh, Dougal Bob. Know,
everything is body parts being hacked off and stuff like that. But then also with that element of horror, you know, I think it is, I mean, Lovecraft's characters are just vehicles for us to experience the cosmic horror, I think, most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Smith sort of falls somewhere between the two, I think. There's not a lot of character necessarily, but the ones there are very finely drawn, I think. You get quite a good sense of the person. I mean, especially things like Satampra Zeros.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into the pseudo sequel, The Theft of the 39 Girdles, because that's one of my favourites. I mean, that could be a Carry On film. Like, seriously, I mean, it's one of the it's like Smith doing high farce, and I think it is a shame that he didn't do more with that character, because I mean, he could have had a Conan on his hands there. You know what I mean? If he'd actually more Fafhrd and Grey Mouser. Yeah. If he'd have gone down that route with Satampra Zeros, I mean, yeah, I think we'd be looking at a very different landscape when it comes to sword and sorcery.
And surely that story must have been a huge influence on Leiber in inventing his characters.
Well, I think it's telling that on the back of the Lost Worlds, the Hyperborea one, that it's actually a quote from Leiber, you know.
Yeah. And I think this is something we touched on before. Smith's view of fantasy as well. He was, although he wrote those science fiction stories, he wasn't particularly into the science aspect.
Scientifiction,
yeah.
Love that word.
It's great, isn't it? It's a shame we don't use that anymore, man. I mean, I love that, scientifiction.
But then someone said to me, but is it science fiction? Or is it scientific fiction? And that I can't quite get it right in my head now.
I was going to say, did your brain melt?
Yeah. You see why they changed it to sci-fi. But, yeah. So this is October 1930, another letter to Lovecraft. As for the problem of fantasy, my own standpoint is there is absolutely no justification for literature unless it serves to release the imagination from the bounds of everyday life. I have undergone a complete revulsion against the purely realistic school, including the French, and can no longer stomach even Anatole France. God knows what I can find to read after I have exhausted the last of your reloaned manuscripts. So again, it's that notion of he's very consciously creating dreamscapes and dreamlike stories and prose poems, almost regardless of the market, perhaps, even though he started writing really to make some money. He was in that state of funerary depletion just outside California.
I mean, we see that a lot in his letters concerning Farnsworth Wright, don't we? How much he decries what he considers the sort of the run-of-the-mill stuff that gets put in weird tales. Whereas, you know, we've talked about this many times, haven't we, Rob? It's like his stories were too weird for weird tales,
yeah.
You know? Which is mind-boggling, isn't it?
He wants some weird tales, but not that weird. Yeah.
It's like, whoa, yeah. I said weird. But
not like that.
Yeah.
But what do you guys think about this as well? It's something we say these were pulp magazines. They're not being read in salons. They're not being discussed in high society. Exactly. Yet they endure, and they're more popular now than ever. These authors,
yeah, they definitely have. They're more iconic, you know, this day and age, and a lot of people kind of like, you know, like have like really same nostalgia, but you know, there's definitely like a deep reverence for them, the stories. Even though they may have read them, they may have just known my reputation. And they just like, you know, just have a deep love for them. And especially when they have like the art, the covers and stuff like that. You know, I do love the, I do love finding some of the old weird tales there. Mm. And I'm glad a lot of them are posted online so I can just go online, you know, and turn off one of the stories and read them then.
Yeah, we recently did a live launch party for the Lovecraftiana magazine's issue that commemorated the first issue of Weird Tales. And to do that, I ended up pulling up the first ever like cover of Weird Tales, and it was absolutely magnificent. You had this man and the man had a knife, and the woman sort of doing the Pearl White scream thing, and there was this great big sinewy tentacle wrapped around her leg. And then just behind her in shadow was this like head with eyes. But it had these little round ears that it looked like a bear. And I couldn't work out whether the bear was watching or the bear had tentacles. Either way, it was brilliant.
For interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah.
That Winnie the Pooh has let himself go. That's all I'm saying.
Paddington goes nuts. Yeah.
But then I suppose the other side of that, and something we've spoken about before, I mean, Dickens was writing for penny dreadfuls and serialisations. Wasn't Conan Doyle doing serialisations for...
Rand magazine, wasn't it, Conan Doyle? Yeah. Right, I mean, yeah. one of the best ones was Ambrose Bierce writing for that Scandal magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when we covered the Damned thing, it was first published in this magazine. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it was a Scandal mag. It was basically like the equivalent of Heat or one of these celebrity magazines. And it was like, who's getting with who and in high society, who, you know, all these kind of like, I saw him with her that night kind of thing. And then you got Ambrose Bierce talking about invisible monsters killing people in a swamp. It's just, yeah, brilliant. The other good example was Stephen King when he had to make some money in his early days. Mm. And he made his money by writing stories for Playboy.
Yeah.
So true. There you go.
Tennessee Williams, you know, he did a few writing for Weird Tales as well.
Yeah.
Before he became Tennessee Williams.
I just wonder who's the arbiter of that, who decides if something is worthy of scholarship or it's just sort of discarded as, you know, nonsense. Because there's a huge amount of Lovecraft scholarship, as we know now. Well, and the same for Robert E. Howard, and I'm sure for Smith as well, to some extent.
Absolutely.
Depends on how popular you are.
Yeah, it's like, who does decide? Strange, isn't it? Who decides that's literature? That's pulp, you know.
And does the scholarship come with the increase in popularity, or does it lead it, or, you know, because wasn't Lovecraft huge in France quite early on? I think there's quite a lot of scholarship in France about him.
Not sure off the top of my head, but it seems to ring a bell. Yeah,
I don't know if that's off the back of the sort of surrealist movement and that kind of thing.
I think there was a little bit in France, but I think it was bigger in Britain.
Yeah,
because I think that he had some articles. Like one of his stories was published in a magazine. I think he was still alive. I'm trying to remember, but I do believe that he had a few things published in Britain. Like one to be printed. There was always that countless moment with Lovecraft where it was kind of like, you know, he's going to get that opportunity to get something printed.
Yeah.
You know, like he's, and it always, you know, pull out from under him, you know, like a future collaboration with Houdini. Probably would have done wonders in his career, but Houdini had the nerve to die on him, you know.
So. I mean, consider it.
So rude.
Yeah.
Well, the classic was Shadow Over Innsmouth, wasn't it? That you had that printed and it was a complete mess. I mean, Rob and I, we've both been in publications that haven't come out the way we hoped. You know, I think most authors have. But I mean, for Lovecraft, he's got this. He's finally going to get a single, you know, he's finally going to get his own standalone release. And it's a complete and total dog's breakfast. You know, such a shame. But, you know.
And the Shunned House, too. one of his friends was going to print The Shunned House as a book for him, but his wife died, and that destroyed his life, and he didn't want to do anything. But he had it printed, but he didn't have it bound. Yeah. So he had all these copies of unbound books, you know, that didn't get done until long after Lovecraft had died.
Wow, that's sad.
August Derlich was the one who did that. He finished that.
Yeah. It's sad that he never really saw that in his lifetime, and I guess Bob Howard as well. And you think Clark Ashton Smith would have at least have seen some of his success. I mean, the sort of paperback surge in the 60s and 70s, he must have seen some of that. I don't know how much he would have earned from it, given the way that contracts and all that kind of thing work.
Well, we can look into that, because obviously a lot of it was actually published by Arkham House, and we've got the letters with Derleth, and a lot of the later letters are concerning these publications. It's something I want to get into when we do another one of our Patreon episodes with the letters. Sure. And but the thing is, this was when Smith wasn't writing, and you know, his fiction writing had basically just stopped. And Derleth is like, dude, people keep asking me for stories. What have you got? And that's when we got reprints of some of these stories. That's what we talked about with The Dud. That was one of those that Derleth was like, look, Weird Tales want a story from you. Send me something and I can get you some money. And it's just kind of how it went at that point.
It is kind of sad that he didn't write much, you know, physics after Lovecraft died. You know, that he it seemed like if he kept writing, that maybe, you know, he might have found, you know, that one thing that would have resonated with everybody and made him the household name, of Howard and Lovecraft.
Yeah.
Had that character. Maybe he would have continued on with one of the characters, you know, that know the story, and he got into rock carving, for a period.
Yeah, sculpting and painting, wasn't it? Became a thing. It was I don't know if it was in the same year, but certainly around the same time. And his parents got very ill and died, and Lovecraft died, and Howard died, and I guess it must have been an extremely depressing time for him. You know, he was having to work in the fields doing manual labor just to get some money in.
And he had his own underlying health issues as well, which I mean, he was plagued by ill health, pretty much all of his life, wasn't he? It's he wasn't exactly the most robust kind of chap. But I think in this Eccentric Impractical Devils, The Letters with Derleth, in the introduction by S.T. Joshi, there's, I think this sums it up nicely, that Smith worked in phases in which he primarily explored one medium more than the others, but not exclusively. When he exhausted one, he worked earnestly in another. He seems to, you know, and that's basically, I think, sums up his mindset. He would work tirelessly on something, because early on it was all poetry, and then he threw himself into fiction, and then he threw himself into the sculpture. I guess he reached a wall, maybe. I don't know. I'm just speculating here, but you know,
that difficult third album, you think?
Exactly. Yeah. The difficult third album. I mean, it's true. Yeah. it's the thing, isn't it? You know.
So, are you going to do your music themed episode? There was one of the most more recent episodes you guys were talking about. You're going to do a specialty episode about music inspired by Clark Ashton Smith's, you know, stories and that type of thing. Cause I know that Lovecraft really has almost become its own genre in music at this point. You've got bands that just not only write a song about Lovecraft, but have their whole persona and aesthetic is about him. They're the Great Old Ones and Necronomicon and all these other ones but I wasn't sure. I didn't know if Clark Ashton Smith had a similar, so there was as many, bands and that type of thing that were, inspired or wrote songs about his music.
There are a few.
Yeah, there is a few.
Yeah, I think there's enough to warrant doing a special on it. And I mean, I think, again, it's similar to the King in Yellow stuff, which once you start looking at that, it's quite surprising how far that spreads out as well in terms of music and, obviously True Detective and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely something we're going to be looking at. We were thinking of a special on adaptations, but then, well, that'd probably only take one, wouldn't it? Given there's so few, we can look at Return of the Sorcerer, and I suppose that Mother of Toads is worth talking about actually, because that's quite a good adaptation.
It was actually really good. I really enjoyed that. I thought that was it's a shame that it wasn't just released on its own as a kind of short.
Yeah,
because the rest of that film was bobbins. I'm sorry, it really was. It was absolute bobbins. I'm sorry.
Well, adaptations, you can go like the Marvel Comics. They did a lot during the 70s of some of Carcass's stuff.
Ah, now there's an idea.
Oh, yeah. Right. I hadn't thought of that. Yes.
And y'all talked about all the ways Carcass may have killed, you know, Lovecraft in his stories.
Oh, no, that's something we're going to do with the Innsmouth Book Club. Yeah. I've been working on it for a while. The deaths of H.P. Lovecraft. We're going to go through as many of us as we can. Because Block killed him, Derleth killed him, Belknap Long killed him, Wondry killed him, Smith killed him two or three times. And then even later, you've got like Pugmire killed him.
Robert Anton Wilson, the Illuminatus, is a character.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Lupoff's Lovecraft's book.
There's one where he's a detective or something with someone. I can't remember. There's quite a lot of stories where Lovecraft appears as a character now.
Oh, that's fairly. Oh, is that Nick Mamatas? Eye Providence.
I'm not sure. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, I can't remember. It's it's quite recent. Quite recent. I say that. I mean, I'm talking about 20 years, but that's recent to me. You know?
that time dilation will get you.
Yeah. Mate, it's still the 80s in my head. Yeah.
Okay, so that about wraps us up for season one. Season two, obviously, we're moving to the next volume in the series, The Daughter Saturn. And just to give you a little idea of what we're going to be covering, the stories, or some of the stories we'll be covering, we're going to start with The Daughter Saturn. And we've got some real favourites in here as well. Rendezvous in Averroine, The Ghoul, The Kingdom of the Worm, The Return of the Sorcerer, which was adapted for TV, something we'll no doubt be looking at, and the City of the Singing Flame. That was another favourite as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, The Hunters from Beyond is another one of mine. I mean, Daughter Saturn is a favourite. Like you say, pretty much all the ones you mentioned are, yeah, absolutely brilliant. But yeah, The Hunters from Beyond, there was something about that I remember. I can't remember the plot of it off the top of my head, but I remember reading it and I remember going, yeah.
That's one of the ones in that Clark Ashton cycle that stuck out to me, because that was in there, and that's one of the ones, yeah, that stuck out to me as well.
Yeah.
The City of Singing Flame is one of my favourites.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great story. And that got a Weird Tales cover, I think, as well, didn't it? That one, there was quite quite an iconic picture of that. Oh, it might have been Astounding magazine, perhaps.
Yeah, one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Something I'm looking forward to, because one of my favourites is Return of the Sorcerer. I mean, that's just a great Cthulhu mythos story. But in the appendices, similar to the Satyr that we covered, there is an alternative ending, which I don't think I've ever read. So that'll be interesting to look. Because we did that before, didn't we, when we got to...
Yes, the Satyr had a different ending. Yeah.
Yeah, so that'll be really interesting to see.
Okay, so that's what we've got coming up in Season 2. Just before we get there, we're going to do a patron special next. We're going to be going through some of the letters between Lovecraft, Smith and Derleth, and pulling out a few choice quotes and subjects to talk about. Then we'll have a short break, and then we'll be cracking in to Season 2. So there we go, our first season. We're very pleased to note that we hit over 1,500 downloads a few weeks back. So we'd like to give a big thanks to everyone who's listened to the show, everyone who supported it, all our guests, all our readers, and of course a big thank to our patrons. And I'm going to try and do this in one breath, so here we go. A big thank you to Chris Carr, Sharon Safia, Rick Seam, Lee Clark Zumpa, Nick Lorimer, Justin Woodman, Russell Journey, Wingate Stites, Lane Mullin, Steve Meyer, Aaron Vleck, Brett Kramer, Benjamin Slade, Gary Pennington, A.T. Johnson, David A. Riley, Rob Weaver, and David Gurney.
Bravo. Bravo. That was almost Trevor McDonald levels of reading there.
And here's Tim with the weather.
Do you want me to get my pointy stick out?
It's going to be fulgurant. And of course, if you'd like to join our patrons in supporting the show, do check out our Patreon page. You can sign up at three tiers of membership. We've been saying for the last month or so, we're going to be rejuggling and rejiggling the tiers, and we will be doing it soon. But basically, you get bonus content for Strange Shadows and the Innsmouth Book Club, and you get a copy of Innsmouth News and various other bits and pieces as well. Free entry to all our events, including the Innsmouth Literary Festival, September the 30th, Bedford, UK. Put it in your diary, folks.
Nice. Yeah. See, that's a reason to sign up right there, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So a huge thanks to our guests, Mark and Richard. Thanks for coming on, guys. It's a pleasure to meet you.
I had an orchidaceous time.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Nice one. Brilliant. Nice one. And with that, it's goodbye from me, Rob Poynton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.